Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Nartrees Podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. The Manifesto for the Abolition of Interest Slavery is a political-economic pamphlet by Gottfried Feder. First published in 1919 and later associated with early National Socialist economic thinking. Written in the aftermath of World War I, it argues that interest-bearing finance is a destructive force that subordinates productive labor and national life to banks and financial capital. Feder presents the text as a practical economic intervention, but it is also an ideological tract, rooted in his hostility toward bankers and his effort to define a new economic order. The book is important less as a workable policy manual than as a historical document that shows how anti-Semitic and anti-financial ideas were fused into extremist politics in Weimar Germany. Readers encounter a stark division between productive capital and interest capital, proposals for abolishing interest, nationalizing banks, and redirecting wealth toward the state. Its influence on the Nazi Party makes it a key source for understanding the economic language of early fascism. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, Feder's division between productive capital and predatory interest capital. A central idea in the book is Feder's insistence that not all capital functions in the same way. He separates productive capital, meaning factories, machinery, mines, and other assets that create goods and employment, from interest-bearing financial capital, which he portrays as parasitic and socially harmful. This distinction is the conceptual core of the manifesto because it allows Feder to defend private production while attacking lenders and bondholders. In his framework, industrial production creates real value, while interest simply extracts value from those who work. That logic is designed to make the book appear economically precise, but it also rests on a moralized and highly simplified understanding of finance. The argument is powerful rhetorically because it is a visible enemy to blame for economic hardship. At the same time, it ignores the role of credit in investment and the complexity of modern banking. The book therefore works as an ideological classification system more than as a balanced economic analysis. Secondly, interest slavery as a political and moral explanation for national decline, Feder treats interest not just as a financial instrument, but as a mechanism of national bondage. The phrase interest slavery is meant to suggest that citizens, workers, and the state are trapped under a system that silently transfers wealth upward to financiers. He presents this condition as both economic exploitation and moral degradation, arguing that the nation loses freedom when interest payments dominate public life. This framing turns a technical subject into a total political diagnosis. The weakness of Germany after the war is explained through finance rather than military defeat, inflation, or structural instability alone. That is one reason the manifesto became useful in extremist politics. It condenses many grievances into a single cause and gives them a dramatic name. The term also makes the book emotionally charged, because slavery implies absolute domination and urgency. In practical terms, however, the concept is vague. It does not clearly define which forms of credit are legitimate, how interest should be abolished, or how an economy would function without it. The slogan is stronger than the policy design. Thirdly, nationalization of banks and the call to replace financial power with state control. The manifesto does not merely criticize bankers. It proposes radical state intervention. Feder supports nationalizing banks and confiscating certain forms of wealth, including war profits, as part of a broader effort to reorganize the economy. This reflects a distinctive pattern in early Nazi economic thought, anti-capitalist language combined with authoritarian state control. The aim is not social democracy or worker ownership in the ordinary sense, but the subordination of finance to a nationalist political project. In that model, the state would decide how money circulates, where credit goes, and which forms of wealth are legitimate. The appeal of this approach lies in its promise of decisive action after wartime chaos and inflation. But its weakness is equally clear. It replaces market discipline and independent institutions with centralized power justified by ideological claims. The book is therefore important for showing how economic policy can be transformed into political control. Its proposals are not neutral reforms. They are part of a larger effort to fuse finance, state authority, and nationalist mobilization. Fourthly, a propaganda text designed to appeal to workers by borrowing socialist language, although Feder later became tied to Nazi ideology. The manifesto uses language that could attract workers and small debtors who felt betrayed by elites. It speaks against unearned income, large financial interests, and speculative wealth, while also endorsing measures such as profit sharing, free education, and higher pensions in the broader political program associated with these ideas. This strategy matters because it shows how extremist movements can borrow the language of social justice without embracing egalitarian politics. The book frames its program as protection for productive people, especially farmers, employees, and small producers who are burdened by debt. That makes the argument persuasive to readers who were suffering from post-war instability and resented urban financiers. Yet the text does not offer a pluralistic or class-based solution in the socialist sense. Instead, it redirects social anger toward financial scapegoats and presents national unity as the answer. The manifesto is thus best understood as persuasion literature as well as economic writing. Its real achievement is rhetorical. It translates complex economic frustration into a simple enemy-centered story. Lastly, why the book matters now as a historical warning about economics scapegoating. The manifesto for the abolition of interest slavery remains relevant because it shows how economic distress can be converted into conspiracy, like political language. Readers studying history, political theory, or the roots of fascism can use it to see how claims about debt, interest, and finance were turned into a total explanation for social crisis. It is not a reliable guide to banking reform, but it is a revealing source on the emotional and ideological uses of economics. The book stands out from ordinary criticism of finance because it does not merely argue for regulation or taxation. It seeks to abolish interest altogether and attach financial power to a nationalist state. That makes it more extreme and historically consequential than standard anti-bank tracts. For modern readers, the practical benefit is analytical rather than prescriptive. The text helps identify how vague economic grievances can be simplified into authoritarian solutions. It should be read critically, especially because of its role in the ideological development of National Socialism. As a historical document, it is valuable precisely because of its danger and its influence. In conclusion, this book should be read by students of history, political economy, fascism, and interwar German politics, especially those interested in how economic language can be used to legitimize authoritarian movements. It is not recommended as a practical manual for finance or public policy, but it is highly useful as evidence of how resentment toward banks, debt, and inflation was transformed into radical political ideology. Readers will gain insight into the intellectual style of early Nazi economics, including its distinction between productive and predatory capital, its hostility to interest, and its appeal to workers through anti-elite rhetoric. What makes it stand out from other economic pamphlets is not analytical depth, but historical significance. Few texts so clearly show the overlap between economic grievance, nationalist mobilization, and political extremism. For that reason, the book is most valuable when read alongside critical scholarship, where its assumptions and omissions become visible. Its importance lies in the way it reveals how simplified economic explanations can become tools of propaganda and authoritarian persuasion. If you would like to support Gottfried Fetter, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.